You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Many of you will remember that my conversation earlier this month with Gail Collins of the New York Times and Pulitzer Prize-winning columnist Connie Schultz of the Cleveland Plain Dealer was cut short by a press conference from Michael Bloomberg on the messed-up transit situation here in New York. We've been talking about the changing roles of candidates' spouses in political campaigns, and I'm pleased to announce that they are back with us again today. Ms. Schultz has written a memoir called And His Lovely Wife about her experiences on the campaign trail with her husband, Ohio Senator Sherrod Brown. It's published by Random House, and you can read Gail Collins' op-ed pieces in The Times every Thursday and Saturday. It gives me great pleasure to welcome them to the show again.
Hi. Thank you. Good to be here.
Connie, when your husband ran for the U.S. Senate, didn't you have to take a leave of absence from the Plain Dealer?
I did. I chose to take a leave of absence, actually sooner than I originally thought I would. He declared in late fall of 2005, and I left the paper in the middle of February of 2006 and was out then for the rest of the year.
And that's because you wanted to campaign actively, or because a newspaper might have felt it was inappropriate for a candidate's wife to be writing about politics?
Well, the newspaper wasn't feeling that way yet. I was certainly feeling it. We're the largest paper in Ohio, and they were having to cover my husband's race. And I could see I was reining myself in a great deal and trying to figure out what I could and couldn't write about. I mean, we have an awful lot in common. We'd only been married a year and a half when he decided to run, and you don't get married middle-aged. At least you shouldn't, unless you have a lot in common. So that we have similar views shouldn't surprise anyone. But I was so keenly aware of the pressure it put on my colleagues, the pressure it was putting on me, and I really couldn't do anything for my husband publicly as long as I was writing for the paper. So I wanted to be a wife to my husband at that point, too. So not that I'm not a wife to him ordinarily, but, you know, you're scrutinized differently when your husband's running for something. And if you're just nowhere to be seen, that's not good over the long haul.
Were you prepared for the type of scrutiny that you received as a political spouse?
I think I got a fairly, I didn't feel a lot of scrutiny from the press, certainly. I think part of it is they didn't quite know what to do with me because I was one of them. And I did a lot of my own speaking for sure, but I had been speaking a long time anyway, as I'm sure Gail does. When you're in this job, you do a lot of public speaking anyway. I wasn't prepared for the unsolicited advice from people, and I certainly wasn't prepared within, I think, 10 days after Sherrod running to be introduced as just his lovely wife, and then to have that happen more than 100 times.
And then
yes,
people,
I was counting.
And then people being critical of you for not changing your name to Connie Brown?
Yeah, that was sort of tiresome, considering I was 46 when I married my husband. But I finally found my way on that issue about May. My dad died during the campaign of a heart attack. He was 69, and my mother had died at 62. And I come from a factory working family. I was the first in my family to go to college, and I finally had my fill of the whole name issue when a couple weeks after my dad died, I was introduced in Southern Ohio as Sherrod Brown's wife, but she's one of those ladies who won't change her name, so here she is. And I thought it was time to start telling the story of my own roots and my own family so they understand that my pride in the name Schultz has far more to do with my own background than anything else.
I'd imagine, Gail, that after you read the memoir, you thought, I'd never want to marry a politician.
Well, you know, I think it's different when you start it that late. I mean, nobody ever wants to be on the campaign trail, I don't think. Once anybody who knows about it, that's a true labor of love. I mean, it's, you know, he owes you forever, really.
Thank you, Gail. Could you tell him that next time you talk to him, please?
Well, in your case, Gail, it would have been impossible to have been on the editorial board of the New York Times and had somebody running for office.
Well, I guess it never came. My husband works for CBS, and never really came up. But it's, you know, this. I've got to say that this is a year that the whole spousal issue relating to the presidential candidates has become utterly, utterly fascinating. We have so many really intense situations of one sort or another involving, you know, the question when the voters really have a right this year to look at the spouses because they're involved in so many different ways in these campaigns. It's way different. I remember when Dwight Eisenhower ran, I was not actually focused on it myself, but it's the first time that, except for Eleanor Roosevelt, it was so totally different, but it was the first time anybody ever used a wife in a campaign ad. They had one that said, here's Dwight's one of the things we really like about Ike is his lovely wife, Mamie, or something like that. But until then, I mean, they were just not a point at all. And it's become so interesting now that you've got so many of these people running in which the spouse is a central part of the campaign in a very kind of policy-making central way. It's really weird and interesting.
Go ahead. I was going to say just yesterday there was a considerable press coverage given to an alleged swipe that Michelle Obama took at Hillary Clinton. She said, if you can't run your own house, you can't run the White House. And that, of course, reminds us about all sorts of stuff that a lot of politicians have to deal with today.
Many of them, when you've got with the Clintons, virtually anything that you can say, if you're the other side, can be taken in some way to be a reference to something strange that's happened in the past. I'm not sure if she was.
I think you're right about that, Gail. And I think it's a little unfortunate when the women go after Hillary because it does become so much more than simply any statement they're making at the time. It's analyzed to death. And there's so much they could be talking about, but of course it's inevitable. If they're going to go after the other opponents, why would they not also talk about Hillary Clinton? I actually was much more impressed with Michelle Obama last week when she, I think she was in south side of Chicago, when she said, we're still playing around with the question, is he black enough? And then she said, just stop that nonsense.
Right. Is somebody else, is Mitt Romney white enough? The tabloids love that sort of thing because they're much happier with that than talking about policy.
Well, I still think there's a tendency to reduce it to a catfight, which is so disappointing. And I certainly have never seen that in Gail's writing. I think that I realize I'm asking women journalists to meet a higher standard than their male peers have because I have so much hope that when we have more women covering politics, it will get better in terms of coverage. I just hope we don't fall for that stereotype. I mean, Michelle Obama or Elizabeth Edwards are perfectly free to criticize Hillary Clinton if they want. It really isn't about gender politics at that point. It's one woman who's married to a candidate speaking about another candidate. And what I hate seeing is when it gets reduced to something else.
Well, so much of it now is about spouses. You wrote in your memoir that, like many women, I'd lived many lives by the time I met Sherrod. And I'm sure that in any number of cases, because now we see so many candidates who are divorced, there was a time when divorce practically disqualified a presidential candidate, that the past lives of the wives and of the husbands wind up becoming as much a political issue as people's positions on things. And now, with Mitt Romney, it's also the sons.
Yeah. Well, he kind of set himself up for that when he said his sons are, they're not serving in the war, they're not in the military, but they are, you know, doing public service because they're working for his campaign.
I mean, the getting him elected president is more important than fighting in Iraq.
Yeah, that wasn't a very smart statement, frankly. I mean,
one and the dog thing are the two things about Mitt Romney that I'm afraid we're going to discuss the entire time, no matter what.
You think they're going to come up again and again?
Oh, the dog, you know, those are just too, I mean, they're just too nifty not to. It's going to be a long, hard campaign, and I think the more we talk about the dog, the better off we all are, really.
But this really does suggest that gossip is a major part of political coverage these days. I don't think it was in the past.
It does not.
It always was. I'm sorry.
Really?
Yeah.
Because
totally.
Many people point out that JFK had secret affairs and nobody talked about it, that everything changed perhaps with Bill Clinton.
Well, the thing about JFK was that, you know, I actually did a book on this at one point in time, and if you look at the stuff that they wrote about him then, if there had ever come a moment when somebody had filed a suit or when somebody had to testify in a trial and had been asked, if there had ever come like a public moment at which the press could grab onto to talk about this stuff, I think you would have gone down the different, you know, Bill Clinton, there were so many rumors about him forever, but the only times that it came back and bit him and became a really big deal were when something hugely public happened. Jennifer Flowers held a press conference, right, or Paula Jones filed a suit, or he had to testify. And
yeah, but that's not what happened with Gary Hart. Gary Hart, really, he just simply said that he denied that he was having that affair, and
well,
then the press caught him.
To bring it on, as I recall, he said, "You know, I dare you to find anything." Well,
he did say that. It turned out he said that it was published like the day it happened, I think. I mean, it was a very kind of weird thing. But what had happened with that one, and it, I truly don't believe that the public in general cares about the private lives of politicians. They're interested in them, and they want to hear about them, whether they admit it or not. But they don't vote on the basis of them. Very, very seldom do politicians get punished for anything that happens in their private life.
Unless, well, do you think that's true, male or female, Gail? Because I don't know that we've had enough women candidates yet.
You probably don't. We don't have enough women to really judge.
Yeah.
But certainly for men so far, there's been very few instances where the public rejected somebody simply because they found out he was having an affair, or because even they found out he was gay. There's tons of, you know, instances, more and more and more. I find it very interesting how many really conservative parts of the country are represented by people who, if you chose to go into the internet and look on blogs and stuff like that, there's all sorts of gossip and rumors
right.
about their
so
sexuality.
The public is less concerned about it
but
than other politicians.
Yeah. Yeah. I would argue, though. I mean, you look at Fred Thompson, who said, yes, all those years I was single, I chased girls and they chased me. I'm trying to think of the woman who could stand up and say, yes, in all the years that I wasn't married, I was chasing guys and they were chasing me. And because you know that what's intimated there, they're sleeping together. I can't imagine a woman surviving that quote.
That's interesting. We'll have to see. It's, I mean, that,
please not.
Well, maybe.
I guess
yeah, sooner or later we're going to have to. Heavens, I hope so. Otherwise,
yeah,
it means
I understand
really
what you're saying, but I couldn't see it right now anyway. A woman candidate being able to say something like that and ever getting away with it.
Yeah, the double standard still applies there. But you know, we're also being presented with the idea that the candidate's spouses are co-candidates. I'm saying spouses because in Hillary Clinton's case, many people think, well, Bill really will have a lot of input. But it's been both ways, and we've seen it with the Edwardses, for example. We saw it early with the Carys. So shouldn't the wives get some of this scrutiny?
You know what? I just think that what's changed is not the marriages. What's changed is the transparency in these marriages. I mean, do we know a healthy marriage where the wife doesn't have a lot of input and what her husband does and thinks and says? And I mean, I don't know any healthy marriages that don't have that kind of partnership. And I suspect marriages typically have been that way. Certainly political marriages that I know, many are like that. They're just not as out with it. And as Gail said at the beginning of the show, we're seeing a very different kind of wife now who's willing to be far more outspoken about her role in her husband's life. And I think that's healthy, frankly. It's just a more honest approach to the whole thing.
So, we've always assumed, in fact, that Nancy Reagan was whispering to Ronnie, and Jimmy Carter said that he relied on Rosalynn for advice. I think it would be ridiculous to assume otherwise, and yet nobody really complained that Rosalynn was the co-president or that Nancy Reagan was.
I mean, if you look at what happened, and I think it's fascinating now, if we had a much clearer outside vision of how the Clinton White House was operating early on, the centrality of, you know, Hillary in that administration is not the same thing as the way Nancy Reagan used to advise, although we would like to know if any wife is scheduling her husband's appointments according to an astrologer's predictions or something, that'd be nice to come up. But you don't imagine that Rosalynn Carter was sitting there in policy briefings helping to decide whether or not to invade a country or to what to do with the budget or who to appoint as attorney general, and the way that Hillary was so absolutely central to those things. And that's a very interesting race. I think I am not at all clear as to all the excited people who turn out for the Hillary rallies, whether they're actually rallying to bring Hillary to Washington or to bring Bill back to Washington. Mm. It's a very together, and I think that's a fair thing for people to ask when they're thinking about that particular candidacy. You know, what if Bill wasn't there, would I still want Hillary to be president? I don't think you feel that same way about, say, if you like Mitt Romney. You're not sitting there saying, if Mrs. Romney, you know, wasn't there for some reason, would I still want Mitt? If Laura Bush wasn't around, would I still want George? If anybody still wants George anyway, that's not the same thing. It's a real difference.
And
Elizabeth Edwards is along much closer to the Hillary Bill line than to the other kind of model.
And I think that Hillary Clinton, it's true that she's unprecedented with the husband that she has, but frankly, any woman, the first woman who was going to become a forerunner in a presidential race, was going to be unprecedented. And this is the set of circumstances we have with Hillary Clinton. I don't know who else could have done this right now. And I, on the book tour that I just finished, it was interesting. I'd be asked sometimes, some objected to what they thought was the Clinton machine involved with Hillary's race, and I said quite bluntly, I don't know that any woman, at least the first woman to be elected president, could do so without a political machine behind her.
And probably without the name and the identification of a previous politician.
Almost every woman who has gotten to the top in any country either had a husband or a father who was famous.
Margaret Thatcher.
Yeah, maybe she may be the only exception. When you look at Asia, pretty much every one of those women who's become a president or a prime minister had a husband and a father. In this country, most of the women who have been in the Senate have been widows of people who had served in the Senate before them. There are a few exceptions there as well.
Certainly the new one, the freshman class, Claire Klobuchar, Amy Klobuchar and Claire McCaskill, came in on their own.
Yeah,
you know, that's the comforting thing I think about this whole model. If you look back, you're absolutely right that in the 19th century and until the 70s, there's the only real consistent model for a woman to get to a governorship, the House or the Senate was that you married somebody who had that, and then they died, and then you somehow came in. There were very, very, very few other people, but. Now that's not true. I mean, you don't see that now. You see all these new people, all the new women are coming in on their own. And I think that the Hillary campaign is that old model. And once we've got sort of the mass, the critical mass we're developing now of women on all the levels of government, it's going to change. And you're not going to require somebody, you know, father or a brother or a husband to be, you know, your sort of surrogate first person out there. But it's just, she's just the first one. And if she doesn't win, I'm really confident that there'll be somebody else.
We have to take a little break. We'll come back to this. My guests are Connie Schultz, who's written a memoir called And His Lovely Wife. It is published by Random House. She is the Pulitzer Prize winning columnist for the Cleveland Plain Dealer. And Gail Collins, who broke all sorts of barriers when she became the chief editorial writer for the New York Times, now op-ed writer every Thursday and Saturday. We're talking about candidates' spouses and how their roles have changed in recent years. Stay with us. We're back with Gail Collins of the New York Times and Connie Schultz of the Cleveland Plain Dealer. It's amazing to hear how friendly you are, considering the fact that Connie won her Pulitzer over a couple of New York Times op-ed columnists. Connie's...
That doesn't mean Connie didn't deserve her Pulitzer, my God.
I didn't say that. I just simply said, I'm sure there was a certain amount of rivalry between the newspapers.
I Gail's work. I have her book. I gave it as a gift to many of women's history. And
oh, that's terrific.
Quinn loves Gail, so I've heard all about Gail.
We love each other.
Well, and of course, there's the memoir And His Lovely Wife, which is published by Random House, about Connie's experiences on the campaign trail with her husband, Ohio Senator Sherrod Brown.
This is so hard to do, to go to campaign, especially to campaign for another person for that long. It's really an extraordinary thing.
Well, people are disinvited in some cases, as we've seen with Judith Giuliani, although her history and his history doesn't seem to, at least as yet, have affected the campaign. Perhaps 9/11 still has more power than any number of wives and secret affairs and all sorts of other embarrassing things that have happened.
Yeah, I don't think, Connie might have a different, I don't think that, although people love to see the wife and it brings people out and they're, you know, happy that, you know, to make that connection, that anybody rejects a candidate because they don't like the spouse, unless there's something about the spouse that reminds them of what they're uncomfortable with about the candidate themselves.
I think you're right, Gail, and the research shows that. I mean, there's been absolutely no research that supports otherwise at this point. Now, that may change as these wives take on more significant roles in campaigns, but so far that's proved to be the case.
Well, in the case of Elizabeth Edwards, she has been outspoken on many issues, including gay marriage, and you have to wonder whether that's going to come back to haunt her husband, or is she taking the role that we've often seen in campaigns where the presidential candidate makes all the nice statements and the vice presidential candidate says all the nasty things, or the things that the candidate really wants said but can't say himself?
Well, that's the theory being posited right now in some pieces. In fact, I think it was last week in the New York Times there was a piece about her role, and I love this. With the walk-off of the story was a political scientist, I think, out of Iowa, and he said, well, we'll see how much John Edwards lets her do that. And I just started laughing at the notion of letting Elizabeth Edwards do anything. I mean,
yeah,
I'm sure you've met her as well. She's a very strong force unto herself, and I don't think she's nearly as strategized or scheduled as people are suggesting right now.
Well, many people applauded when she confronted Ann Coulter on national TV about Coulter's use of personal attacks, but some also wondered aloud why John Edwards hadn't confronted Coulter himself.
Well, the thing I saw in that, if I had been a consultant, I would have, I watched it when I saw a replay of it, and I thought, you know, what she just did was give Ann Coulter at least a whole other 24-hour news cycle, which you never want to do on a campaign.
And in fact, I'm always embarrassed when I even mention her name.
Yeah, right. I mean, I've succeeded so far in never writing about Ann Coulter for that very reason. I just don't want to give her any more play.
From your experience on the campaign trail, do you think that part of your role was to help humanize your husband?
That, but I thought he was mighty human already. I think that's, you know what it is, Leonard? There are so many stereotypes that really prevail here, and I would never have married a stereotypical politician. I never thought I was going to marry a politician to begin with, but people would say that on occasion. I think more of it simply was, you know, I was down in southern Ohio a lot for the campaigning, because that's down in Appalachian, down in a lot of working class neighborhoods, because that's where I come from, and I went down there because Sharon couldn't be everywhere, and I certainly couldn't be everywhere either, but I could be a lot of places where he couldn't be, and I wasn't going to sit home and do nothing. I mean, that was part of it too, is I can understand these wives. Not all of them have to give up their careers the way I had to at that point. I didn't give up my career. I gave up my job for a while. And I understand some of them can keep working and do what they do. I couldn't. So what was my alternative? I wasn't just going to sit home and feel sorry for myself.
Although there is a difference when your husband is or your wife is running for Senate and when they're running for president.
Oh, sure.
And you are really – different things are expected of you. Howard Dean's wife came under criticism for not going out and campaigning for him. On the other hand, there are those recipes that seem to be demanded of presidential or possibly presidential wives. We had Hillary's chocolate chip cookies, and then Teresa Hines Carey submitted a pumpkin spice cookie recipe.
Which didn't work out well.
It was so poorly.
It's so silly. You know, there were a couple of requests that came to the campaign last year about any kind of I love to cook. I am not handing out recipes because I just felt that is not what I normally would be doing. I remember when my husband's opponent, his wife, had a cookbook that was published by the Republican Party, and she would hand it out everywhere she went. And I was about to have my first book come out with Random House, and this one reporter, poor guy, calls the communications director of the campaign and said, well, so-and-so's handing out this cookbook. I wonder what Sherrod Brown's wife's going to be handing out. She said her book from Random House, and she hung up the phone.
Well, you should have included a recipe somewhere in the middle of the book. Take care of that.
Yes, you know, they would send me down to these rural areas and small towns, and it'd be standing room only often. It's not because they wanted to meet, you know, they had heard about me personally, but they had heard that this guy had a wife who writes for a living and has got a lot of her own opinions, and they had a curiosity about that, and they loved it. They didn't have to do what I do for a living to appreciate what I was doing for my husband, and there's a big difference, I think.
Are you so much in agreement with him that you never have to worry about writing something that will be contrary to his position?
Not always, no. I don't agree on some things. I think
will that be embarrassing?
Well, no. I mean, he and I are always going to disagree on the flag-burning amendment. You know, I'm a First Amendment purist, as you would expect me to be in the profession I'm in. But overall, we agree. But again, as I said at the beginning of the show, you're insane to marry somebody that you don't have a lot in common with when you're doing it in your late 40s. Who needs that heartburn? I don't.
My guests are Connie Schultz, who's written a memoir called And His Lovely Wife, about her experiences on the campaign trail with her husband. It's published by Random House. And Gail Collins, whose op-ed pieces appear in the New York Times every Thursday and Saturday. Connie, when do your articles appear in the Cleveland Plain Dealer?
They run Tuesday and Friday, and I think that they run with Creator Syndicate, and I don't know when more and more papers are picking up, but I don't know when it runs around the country. But Tuesdays and Fridays in the Plain Dealer.
This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Gail, there is a temptation always when a candidate's spouse makes a faux pas for the op-ed columnists to use that in their columns. I suspect you've been tempted more than once.
Oh yeah, truly. It's, you know, the problem that we have here is that our campaigns are so wicked long. Mm-hmm. We're talking about another 14 months of this we're talking about another year before we get to the presidential nominating convention.
But if they move up the primaries any sooner, we may be voting next week.
Well, we'll be voting for the primaries, and then we'll have a year and a half of just two people. And when you've got that long a time, people always are talking about how important it is to talk about the issues, and it really is important to talk about the issues, but we've gone through, I can't tell you in the years that I've done all the jobs I've done, sitting around saying, well, should we be looking at the details of their medical health plan now in August when we've got a year and a half to go, or should we wait till people are more focused? It's not as if we don't do all the other stuff, but there are just a lot of days out there, and people do tend to look for stuff that, you know, you can kind of talk about easily that's not too painful, and the spouses are indeed one of the things that come up. Any kind of a blunder or a gaffe or anything unusual or strange is just always sort of fodder because you're so desperate to find things to write about.
The press seems to be poised to pounce on the next macaca moment.
Yeah, well, that's the interesting thing this time is that you've got all of these YouTube clips that are circling around all over the place. And if you go back and look at some of these candidates, particularly the ones who are sort of reinventing themselves this time around, and look at some of the YouTube clips on some of them, you just can't imagine that once these things are turned into commercials, it's not going to be just unbelievable.
Well, what's going to happen, I think, is badly scripted and tightly scripted as campaigns have been in the past, it's only going to get worse.
Yeah.
And that's just so unfortunate for everyone involved. And, you know, that's going to be staff and consultants weighing in. Most candidates are better than you'd think they'd be if they just be themselves. The problem is they get so worried about the talking points, staying on message, you know, all the packaging that goes with it, and you end up having a real inauthentic version of who that person is, and that is, to me, alarming when you start to think about what it could mean. How much will we actually know about the people that we're supposed to be voting on? That's what concerns me the most about that.
But what do we want to know about those people? Because I recently had a political analyst who said that we don't really need to know what the health plan is. In fact, those kinds of policy statements have very little impact on any campaign. We want to know what the person is like.
I think that's appalling. I don't know how you feel, Gail, but I want to know what they think in terms of, I mean, look at the major issues confronting us right now. We don't want to know how they're going to solve this, how they're going to attempt to solve the health care crisis. Do we really not want to know what their plan is on the Iraq war?
As a voter, I'm tending more and more, I guess, in my old age, to become more in the middle about this. I want to know certainly what their goals would be on the health care, but I also want to know whether they're, not what they're like personally when they're at home with their family, but whether they have the sort of personal skills that are necessary to get their thoughts through into a law.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't, you know, you look at, say, Dennis Kucinich, you know, who has just all sorts of thoughts, and their thoughts coming out all over the place. But when I look at Dennis Kucinich personally, I see a person that could never, you know, could never get a bill 3 inches. So that it's sort of beside the point if they have great thoughts or great goals if they don't have the skills necessary to get them through. And
what you're talking about is he or she a leader?
Yeah. But what that means, which is a real good question. And the interesting thing to me too is, like, if you look at, say, Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama, you've got in Barack Obama a person who's not I mean, he's getting more scripted, but he's a person who's actually trying to fight that. You can see his own desire not to be a person who goes around like a robot all day, saying the same thing over and over again. And Hillary Clinton, you have a person who does really go around like a robot all day, saying the same thing over and over again. She personally, if you actually speak to her, is a much more normal human being. But
yes,
which do you really want, though? Do you want a person who is more fun to cover if you're a reporter, but who's capable of making a mistake that could create a huge disaster down the line? Or do you want somebody who's really boring and repetitive but probably won't get into trouble?
Right.
It's an interesting question.
I don't ever need to feel I can go out for beers with the person elected.
Which is a good thing, because there are not a whole lot of ones you'd want to, I think, at this point.
We have to leave it there. Maybe we can get together later and have some beers amongst us. Connie Schultz of the Cleveland Plain Dealer, Pulitzer Prize winner, and author of a new memoir called And His Lovely Wife. It's from Random House. And Gail Collins, who is formerly the editorial page editor of the New York Times from 2001 to 2007, now writes an op-ed column for the Times every Thursday and Saturday. It's been a great pleasure having both of you on the show.
Thank you. It's been an honor to share time with Gail Collins. I'm so glad you're on the op-ed pages.
Back at you, Connie.